are beginning a new series this morning, and it's one that I've been planning for a year and been thinking about for a very long time, and I'm excited to get into today with you. And we're calling it Unbelievable. And we're talking about the task, the difficulties of maintaining and believing and acting out this ancient faith of Christianity in the midst of the modern world. And what does it mean? And what we're going to do is today we're going to kind of set a foundation. I'm going to talk about the nature of faith itself, and I'm going to tell some personal stories about my faith and how it's developed and how the Lord has brought me along. And then over the next 6 weeks, we're going to look at different questions, different obstacles that people have that keep them from believing, that keep them from the church. And I'm excited to share those with you, and we're going to be just as honest as we can, and we're going to invite you to ask questions and hopefully just invite you to let your guard down and open yourself up, open your heart up, open your mind up to the possibility of belief. That's our prayer for you this morning. And we're going to start, and this is the reason why this is so important to me is it's very personal. Even though I'm basically, I don't guess there's any basic to it. I'm paid to be a Christian. It's kind of a weird, kind of a weird position when you think about it. But I mean, that is kind of number one job requirement. If you're a pastor, you kind of have to be a Christian, at least in this denomination. And so, I'm paid to believe. And even though I'm paid to believe, it is not easy. It has not been an easy road for me. And it is oftentimes hard, even today, maybe in some ways harder than ever. And it's been a struggle. It was a struggle early, and it's been a struggle at different times all along. And yet, all the way through there, I've always just been unable to get away from this constant awareness that I'm not alone, that God is with me. When I was in college is really when it became the hardest for me, when I came the closest to the precipice of unbelief. I'd gone through high school, my father left the home, and I've shared that story with you, and it was just very dark, and it was a dark time in college. I didn't know a lot of people. I was lonely, and I got into the Christian community, and I even became this crazy thing called a Calvinist who believes in the sovereignty of God. And that made me really mean for a while. And during the midst of all that, my brother's wife left him. She asked for a divorce. And just kind of still very much smarting from the sting of divorce, I began pleading with God. My brother did not want this. He begged her not to. He begged God not to. And I began pleading, fasting, and praying. And becoming a Calvinist made this very hard for me because God can change a heart. That's the number one principle. God changes hearts. And so I was praying and doing, I felt like a pretty good job of arguing my case before God. God, you can change a heart. God, you answer prayers according to your will. And it says in the Bible, you don't like divorce. So divorce can't be your will. Stop this. Change her. Stop this. And he didn't. He didn't. And as I watched my brother get abandoned and spiral into loneliness, I spiraled into darkness. And one night, I went out on campus talking out loud, and I said, God, even if you do exist, if you're not going to do something like this, what good are you? What good are you? If you're not going to answer prayers and you're not going to see the tears and the pleadings of your people, what good are you? And I walked up to the precipice of unbelief and I jumped. I said, I don't believe in you anymore. I'm giving up. I'm done. I quit. I don't believe in you anymore. And I heard or felt, whatever you're theologically comfortable with, a small, quiet voice say, then who are you talking to? And at that point, I just realized, as much as I didn't want to believe, I did. And the question wasn't so much whether I believed or not. The question was, did I like him? And was I at peace with him? And as we live in a world where, despite advances and despite the sense of less and less, if you read the news or you just kind of absorb culture, you think that belief in God is dead, it's over. But in actuality, what we're seeing is more and more religious activity throughout the world. Even to the point of causing political events and national emergencies. It's in the name of God. The belief in God isn't going anywhere. And honestly, I think the question is not, is there a God? But it's, who is it? And how can we make peace with Him? And what I want you to see today is that God is a personal God. He's personal. And to know Him, you have to know Him as a person. You have to know Him as a person. He's not a concept. He's not a theory. As we go into this series, I'm not going to do proofs of God's existence. I'm not going to try to prove to you He exists. A proof, just that sentence implies that He's a mathematical equation, like A squared plus B squared equals C squared. He's not a geometry equation. I don't even remember what that means. But He's not something in physics that you discover. There are problems with that idea, even though it's a very popular idea that you can prove Him. If you could prove His existence, then He would be only findable to the intelligent. He would only be findable to the scholar. If He was a proof that we, if it was our job to kind of look over Him and say to Him, prove to us that You exist, that puts us in an awkward, wrong relationship from the beginning. It puts us on the judgment seat saying, prove to me Your existence. And it puts Him in the defendant's chair. And as you read the Bible and as you walk with the Lord, you find out He doesn't like, matter, He just won't get in that position. That's just never going to be the position you're ever in. He's personal. And to know Him, you have to know Him as a person. Paul says to us in 1 Corinthians, where does this leave the philosophers, the scholars, the world's brilliant debaters? God has made the wisdom of this world look foolish, since God in His wisdom saw to it that the world would never know Him through human wisdom. He has used our foolish preaching to save those who believe. God is personal. The only God who actually exists is personal. And to know Him, you have to get to know Him the way you get to know a person. Okay? What does that mean? First of all, it means a relationship with a person starts with trust. It starts with a level of trust. You don't just kind of, you know, come to, I guess you do now on the internet, but you don't basically come to people and say, give me your resume and I'll decide whether you have a friend relationship with you or not. You just kind of start out kind of committing a little bit to them, right? You meet somebody on the street. You don't make eye contact at first, right? You kind of see them out of the corner of your eye. Get a sense. Is this someone safe to look at? I don't know. Yeah, he looks safe. I don't see a gun. Okay. I'll look at him. I'll trust him enough to look at them. Does he look safe to talk to? Okay, I'll talk to him. As you get to know him, he starts asking you for your phone number. Do I trust him enough to give him my phone number? Do I trust him enough to share personal information with him? And as that goes, the relationship develops. God comes to us. When He came to us in the form of Jesus, His relationship with us was very much like that. Look at how it starts. What we're going to do today is go through the book of John, and we'll show you different kind of milestones in the relationship between the disciples and Jesus and how they develop that relationship. And we'll start with where they first meet. In John chapter 1, we'll see this. The next day, John the Baptist was sitting with his two disciples, and he looked at Jesus as he walked by and said, behold, the Lamb of God. The disciples heard him and say this, and so they followed Jesus. Jesus turned and saw them following and said to them, what are you seeking? That's a funny question, I think. What do y'all want? They said to him, Rabbi, which means teacher, where are you staying? Which I think they just weren't expecting the question, so that was the best they could come up with. And he said to them, come and you'll see. Isn't that great? He doesn't just immediately overwhelm them with his godness, his deity. He invites them to come. Come and see. Walk with me and see. So they came and they saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. And one of the two who heard John speak and followed Jesus was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. So he first found his own brother Simon and said to him, "We found the Messiah," which means Christ. He brought him to Jesus, and Jesus looked at him and said, "You're Simon, the son of John. You should be called Cephas," which means Peter. The next day, Jesus decided to go to Galilee, and he found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." He doesn't overwhelm them with signs. He just looks at them and he says, "You want to know who I am? Follow me. Walk with me." And then he looks at Peter, and this is just hilarious. He looks at Simon, who's clearly, we know he's going to become the leader of the disciples pretty much immediately. He's the leader of the church, and must have just had something in his presence and his bearing that just said, "You know, I'm kind of the bull in the ring. You know, I'm the leader." And so he looks at him and says, "I'm going to call you Peter." That's just hilarious. He changes his name. On their first meeting, he changes his name. What's he doing? He's saying, "Simon, we're going to call you Peter. If you want to follow me, you're going to let me name you. If you want to follow me, you have to understand this relationship. I'm not calling for your complete obedience yet. I'm not going to call you to die for me today. But I am going to call you to be in a relationship where you understand that I'm the bull in the ring. You're going to submit to me from this point on. It's a relationship. That's how relationships work. They start with trust. They start with understanding who you're with. And you discover safety. It starts with that step of humility first. That, am I going to humble myself? Am I going to follow this person? C.S. Lewis said his spiritual journey began when he realized that to claim to be an atheist would mean saying that 95% of humans who had ever lived, 95% of every human who's ever lived is completely wrong about the thing they claim to believe in the most. To be an atheist, to say that there is no God, means that you're saying that 95% of the humans who've ever lived on this planet are absolutely wrong, not about something small, not about, you know, their favorite football team, which we all know is the Bears, but they're completely wrong about their God, about something that they care about deeply. And C.S. Lewis said he just could not be that arrogant. He took that first step of humility, that first step of submission. He opened his heart up to the possibility. Will you just do that? Will you just open your heart up and say, maybe not every human who's ever claimed to have a spiritual experience, maybe not everybody who's ever claimed to have been touched or affected or to experience something beyond nature, maybe they're not all crazy. Will you just open yourself up to that as a possibility? Can we just start there? It starts with this opening up, this humility, this trust, and the relationship grows, and you entrust yourself more and more to that person. And you find, as you do that, you find that you develop a friendship, and a friendship is an oasis. It's a place of rest. And the disciples discovered that. Jesus taught a sermon. He fed all these people, 5,000 people, so they all came back for another free lunch. And he said to him, "This time, I'm going to be the meal. You're going to have to eat my body and drink from my blood." And they didn't understand. And they thought, this guy's getting weird. And so they all left. It was the worst sermon in history. He went from 5,000 followers to 12. I don't know how he was planning on finishing that building campaign, because you just can't do that. And he looked at the 12 and he said, well, what does it say? It's in your bulletin. After this, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. And Jesus asked them, "Do you want to go away as well?" And Simon Peter answered him, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, and we have believed and come to know that you are the Holy One of God." Where would we go? This relationship is a safe place. It's the only safe place. A friend of mine named Shane is a pastor in Georgia, not the Shane that y'all know. What's another one? He's a pastor in Decatur, Georgia, and he and some friends were at a funeral, actually, and after the funeral they went to a restaurant to get a meal together, and they were fellowshipping and talking about what Jesus was doing and how faithful God had been to them. And Somebody at the bar, this is every preacher's like worst nightmare. Somebody at the bar who's about five Jack and Cokes into his day, just all of a sudden turns around and goes, "Jesus, you guys are talking like a bunch of pastors." And Shane kind of turns around to meet him. And what he doesn't realize is when he turns around, the other two guys back up. And so he's all by himself. And the guy goes, "I want to tell you about my life and tell me what you think Jesus has for me." And so Shane's like, "That's not what I was going to do today, but okay." And this guy began to pour on him his life story with anger and with fierceness. His father had abandoned his mother before he's ever born. He's never met his father in his life. His mother went from abusive boyfriend to abusive boyfriend. And over and over again, he would sit in the house and watch these men that he barely knew beat his mother and oftentimes beat him. He was so angry that as soon as he graduated, before he graduated, he just left the area, got as far away as he could, and to try to support his mother, he actually went out to California and got involved in the pornography industry. And made money there in abusive relationships, and there he got into drug abuse and all kinds of physical just issues, and evidently that's not a healthy lifestyle, he knew. And he was back today. The reason why he was back in town was because his mother had finally snapped and killed one of her boyfriends, and he was there to testify in her trial and to be with her. And he said to him, "What do you think Jesus would say to me?" And Shane looked at him and he said, "Well, I think he'd be very sorry because you've been hurt by great evil in this world. And he would be sorry because you've hurt yourself. You made a lot of bad decisions. And you're responsible for a lot of the pain yourself. And he would tell you that even though you have made a lot of bad decisions, it's not too late for you. And he would offer you hope. And he would want you to know that every time you pick up that glass, or every time you indulge yourself in the sexual fantasies and sexual relationships, what you're really looking for is him. What you're really looking for is him, and he's the only place where you can find peace. That relationship becomes an oasis, and it's the only place you can find life. And that's what most of us in the church have discovered. If you begin asking people or asking around, what you'll find is that most Christians didn't want to be Christians. They just found that this was the only place to find life. And it wasn't life anywhere else. You develop a friendship. It starts with trust. It develops into friendship. And then it develops into something more. At the Last Supper, Jesus says to them, he's going away, and the disciples get sad and they start weeping and asking him questions. And he said, "Well, you know where to find me." And Thomas said to him, "Lord, we don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way?" And Jesus said to him, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you do know him and you have seen him." God is personal, and he came to earth as a person, and we know him as a person. And this thing happens as you get into a relationship. If you get into a truly meaningful, deep relationship, you begin to know yourself. You begin to know the world through this relationship. It unveils yourself to you. It doesn't happen quickly, but it does happen. My wife and I were married for 20 years before we learned how to talk to each other. And actually, that's faster than some. But now we've kind of learned, and so I have to ask her a question every week. Every day, every Friday at lunch, I ask her the same question, and it's embarrassing every time. And honestly, I think the question is silly. The question is, how are you experiencing me? Isn't that just dumb? Does that sound like something that would come from my mouth, honestly? But what I'm really asking is, who am I? I thought I knew. I thought I was smart and funny and right all the time. I thought I knew who I was, but I'm beginning to realize that I don't. Who am I? You begin to find yourself. And as you find yourself, you're able to see what's lacking and what's not there and what ought to be there, and you begin to find your way. And that's what our relationship with the Lord becomes. It becomes this place where the relationship itself reveals to us the truth. And it not only enables us to see ourselves, it enables us to see everything else. In that truth, we find truth for living, the truth about the world, how the world works. Again, C.S. Lewis says that he believes in God for the same reason he believes the sun has come up. Not because he can see it, but because by it he can see everything else. By this relationship, I'm enabled to live. By this relationship, I understand me. And I'm given the humility and the grace to live in this world that's around me. It's how I understand everything else. And then finally, there's a final step in this relationship, and it's where you find peace. It's where you find peace. Jesus looks at Peter one last time. It's after Peter has betrayed Jesus over. He's denied that he even knows him. I'm sorry, Judas betrayed Jesus. Peter denied that he knew him. And after the resurrection, Jesus comes back to Peter, and three times he says, "Do you love me? Do you love me?" And the final time he says, "Peter, do you love me more than these?" And Peter looks at him and says, "Lord, you know me. You know everything. You know that I love you." And then Jesus begins to tell him, "You're going to die for me, Peter. You're going to be crucified for me, Peter." And so Peter looks back at John and says, "What about him? This isn't fair." And Jesus says, "What does that matter to you? You follow me." Even in the deepest, most unknown, scariest places of life, follow me. I'm the resurrected one. Trust me. Follow me. That is how this relationship with God is. That's how we know God. We don't know Him the way you know that E equals MC squared. I don't really even know for sure that E does equal MC squared. I hear it does. I hear that's how atomic energy is made. I don't know. But you know Him the way you know a person. And He knows you. For me, that trust relationship started from my mom. It was handed to me from her. She has a very simple but very profound faith. Her faith really developed roots on the night that her first husband had left her, and she filed for divorce. And the night before she went to court, her lawyer called her and said, "We're going to court tomorrow. Are you ready?" And she said, "I guess I'm as ready as I'm going to be." When she hung up the phone, she grabbed her Bible, and she was crying, and she was grief-stricken, and she was terrified. And she opened the Bible, and by God's grace, He put Psalms in the middle. So when you're really desperate, you tend to turn there. And she turned to Psalm 46. "The Lord is my rock and my fortress, a very present help in time of trouble. Therefore, I will not fear, though the earth give way, though the mountains shake with their trembling." And He found peace. She found peace. And she raised me in the presence of that. So I would just start. So that relationship would start. That's not where it ended. That's just where it started. And then as I continued on in that phase, I found it to become an oasis for me. When I got to college, I've told you before, I was a mess. And I was a failure socially. I didn't have any friends. I was so lonely that I honestly believed, and I believe to this day, that if I had left college in the middle of the night, left my dorm room and locked the door, nobody would have missed me. I'm absolutely convinced of that. I was unable to make a single meaningful, even superficial friendship my freshman year. I was a failure academically. Up until that point, I knew myself and I understood myself by being the smartest person I had ever known. And that self-identification absolutely evaporated the second I stepped onto Vanderbilt's campus. I became the dumbest person I knew, and I came within 1/1000th of a point from failing out. I had failed morally. I had failed spiritually. I'd failed in every way that mattered to me, and I was absolutely lonely. And what I found at that point was the Christians on campus were the only ones who were nice to me. They were the only people who would talk to me. They were the only people that I could be safe around. Now, what I later found out was they had a campus minister telling them they had to be nice to me, but it's okay. It worked. And that became my oasis. And that protected my faith as it began to develop. And it's interesting, and I want you to know that you will believe what the people around you believe. You're designed that way. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 15 that bad company corrupts good morals. And when we hear that, we think, well, you're right, around people who smoke pot, you're going to smoke pot, and that's bad. But he's not talking about that kind of morals. He's talking about the resurrection and belief in the resurrection. And you're going to believe what the people around you believe. I came face to face with that when during my sister's funeral a few years ago. I just realized that I would never be able to believe the resurrection without the church, without people around me who believed it too. The community, the church becomes an oasis. It becomes a place for tactless and afraid people to find life. And as this relationship developed, the Lord was just gracious to me. I found light in this relationship. I found that I was able to see the world through it. And you know how it feels to be attacked. You don't, if you're in an atheistic or relativistic world, it's usually not kind of frontal confrontation. It's always to the side. It's always from the back. It's always just this general scoffing and mocking, this sense of, you don't really believe that, do you? I mean, it's okay that, you grew up going to church. We all did, but you don't really believe it. And honestly, at times I felt like I was just almost below water and I could just breathe. And the Lord just kept giving me just enough to stand on. And he did it in the funniest ways. I was in a biology class and the professor was teaching on evolution of all things. He was teaching on evolution. And I don't know why he said this, but for some reason, as he was teaching about progress through the modern, the development of higher beings through mutation and through change, unexpected chaotic change, he just stopped in the middle of everything and he said, if you understand the cell at all, you'll understand that even there's no possibility that the slightest mutation would improve a cell. He said that the odds of a mutation improving a cell are infinitesimal. That was the exact sentence. I wrote it down. It was the only note I took that day. And I just thought, why did he say that? I don't think anybody else heard it. But I did. And it was just enough to keep believing. I was in physics the next year. That was the year that I came that close to failing out, and I was writing down everything this teacher said because I was dying. And he says, all of a sudden, just out of nowhere, as he's talking about one of the principles of physics, he said, the only reason we know for sure that the principles of physics are unchanging would be if they are based on the existence of an unchanging God. If we did not have an unchanging God, we would have no idea whether these laws would be true one day after another. He just kind of kept going with it, and I was kind of looking around going, did anybody else hear that? Was crazy. One day I was Western civilization. We were studying the second half of Western civilization, and I was looking at all the wars between Protestants and Catholics, and I was looking at had to do all these philosophical readings and Hume and all these Nietzsche and all these scoffers and seeing how they didn't believe, and I really felt like I was just back at that precipice of unbelief, and I just said. Again, I prayed out loud a lot back in those days. I didn't have any friends, so I wasn't really worried what people thought. And so I just kind of was talking out loud to God, not to myself. That's important. And I said, God, it seems like if you were really there, somebody would have found you by now. I mean, from Plato to Aristotle to Anselm to Descartes and Hume, somebody should have found you by now. And in God's providence, I was also taking history of Christianity that year. And I thought, wait a minute. Ambrose, Augustine, Athanasius, Chrysostom, Luther, Calvin, Wycliffe, Huss, Wesley, Whitfield, Spurgeon. I guess people have found him. And it's all the same thing. They all believe the same truths. It is there. And even at the very end, I was 3 weeks from going into the ministry full time. I was just about to finish college and I went straight into the ministry from college. And it was kind of like my last just leap of like, am I sure I want to do this? And I went into this atheistic professor. He's a professor of history of American thought. He was a worldwide expert on Puritans and Reformed theology and doesn't believe any of it. And after listening to him for a whole semester and learning a lot, I went into him and I said, can I ask you a question? He said, sure. I said, I am one of those Calvinists you've been talking about. He said, oh, really? I didn't know y'all were around. I said, am I committing just intellectual suicide? Is that just crazy that I still believe this stuff? And he said, actually, honestly, I believe Calvinism is the most consistent world and life view a person can possibly have. I just don't believe it. I thought, well, thanks. I'll pray for you. And left. The Lord was just there. He was just keeping me there, walking with me, giving me what I needed through the most unexpected people, through the most unexpected avenues. He was speaking to me. He was maintaining this relationship. But that still didn't give me the peace that I was looking for. Okay, God, so you're there, but I still don't like you. And why would you worship and serve a God who just, what good are you? Who wouldn't cure my pain? And God began talking to me about that through a children's book. It's a book called The Magician's Nephew. And in that book, written by C.S. Lewis, he has the scene where the boy named Diggory, his mother is dying, and he's just dying inside to ask Aslan to save his mother's life. And Aslan has all these other things that he wants Diggory to do. And he's got this big task that Diggory has to go and complete. And Diggory doesn't care about that. He doesn't want to do that. He wants his mother to be healed. And he's looking at his feet and he's crying. And he finally summons up all of his courage. And he says, but can't you do something for my mother? Isn't there anything you can do? And at that point, he summoned his courage to look up into the lion's eyes. And C.S. Lewis says this. He says, what he saw surprised him as much as anything in his whole life. For the tawny face was bent down near his own. And great shining tears stood in the lion's eyes. They were such big, bright tears compared with Diggory's own that for a moment he felt as if the lion must really be sorrier about his mother than he was himself. My son," said Aslan, "I know grief is great." And through this children's book, I began to realize that the true God, the only God I could ever worship, is the God who is not immune to pain, that God Himself has felt pain. He grieves for us and with us. Genesis 6 says that God saw the violence that humans were doing to each other, and it grieved him to his heart, and he was sorry that he had made man. It hurts him deeply. It hurts him more than it hurts us. His heart is bigger than ours. He is more loving than ours. He is more pure than we are. And our grief hurts him more than it hurts us. And that's the only God I could believe in. To quote John Stott, in a world that is filled with pain, who could worship a God who is immune to it? And God shows us that not only does He feel pain with us, but through His pain, through the pain that He voluntarily took on the cross, He is bringing about an end to ours. He is bringing hope. And He is bringing light. And that's where I found peace. I want you to find more than knowledge of God. I want you to find peace, and I hope you find it there. Please pray with me. Father,